My calendar says 2016. Your calendar says 2016. In the world of financial regulation, though, it is still firmly 2008. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 13th of April, 2016, as I said, glad you could be with us. We're going to begin today with a stipulation that the big banks in this country are very big, bigger in some cases than before the financial crisis, big enough perhaps to do serious economic damage should things go south the way they did in 2008. Objections? All right, hearing none, I will proceed. The regulatory imperative in the wake of Lehman Brothers and AIG and all the rest has been to find a way to limit the damage that might be done if, or maybe when, there's another big crisis and the big banks get stressed. To that end, this morning, five of the biggest too-big-to-fail banks in this country were told that they had failed to meet the requirements of something referred to as the living wills portion of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, just like in life, a way to find a merciful and non-economy-destroying end should those banks be headed toward their demise. The thing is, not meeting the standards might not be completely the bank's fault. From New York, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
So, yeah, these living wills, still very much a work in progress. Patricia McCoy is a professor at Boston College Law School.
It's been a long, drawn-out process on both sides.
From the banks and their regulators, the FDIC and the Federal Reserve.
These are very complicated plans to draw up. They take a long time. And then they're very complicated plans for federal regulators to review.
The review process is still evolving. It's often described as iterative. Don Lampson is a lawyer at Squire Patton Boggs.
Banks have been complaining for some time. Tell me at the beginning what it is you want, rather than have me create a plan and then I have to guess at that. And then you tell me later it's not what you want.
Of course, Lampson says the counterargument is that you don't want banks to know so much that they can game the system.
There is a reasonable position for both sides here.
Lawrence Evans with the Government Accountability Office recently reviewed this regulatory process. He found the FDIC and the Fed had refined it and are coordinating well, but he recommended they be more transparent with the banks.
They do get guidance. Sometimes we found issues with the timeliness of the guidance, but we thought, you know, just providing this framework would be key.
The Fed and the FDIC actually agreed with that transparency recommendation, and Evans thinks the findings they released today are moving in the right direction. But Anat Admati at Stanford thinks the regulators are still being too tepid.
They are coming close now, but they are not actually daring to say fail on this test. And so they just keep iterating.
She says if we're not careful, we'll iterate ourselves right into another crisis. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
All right, just to stick with a theme here, how about another stipulation? Here you go. The U.S. is the bright spot right now in the global economy. China is sputtering. Europe is meh. So we're it. And when I say we, I mean us, you and me, the American consumer. And the pressure is on. We learned this morning that retail sales fell last month. Not a lot, but enough. And doubly or triply bad when you consider flat sales in February and a drop to start the year. So Marketplace's Annie Baxter has more now on you and me and the global economy.
Scott Anderson says some of the recent softness in retail sales is somewhat perplexing. He's chief economist at Bank of the West.
It's really hard to see any real fundamental reason. You know, if you look at job growth, we're maintaining, you know, well over 200,000 jobs a month. Unemployment rate remains steady.
Anderson suspects consumer confidence took a hit in recent months due to things like negative presidential campaign rhetoric and stock market volatility earlier this year. Tom Leonard gets that. He's president of Fury Motors, a Twin Cities auto dealer.
My standpoint is, it was a typical reaction to a dip in the stock market.
Market volatility can make consumers skittish about big purchases. Leonard says traffic at his stores was down in January and February, but he saw improvements last month, despite the fact that nationally, auto sales dropped sharply. And he's optimistic about sales in future months.
What we're seeing with our customers' ability to buy reflects that.
Why this all matters, of course, is that the U.S. consumer is doing a lot of heavy lifting lately for the global economy. Here's Chris Christopher, economist at IHS Global Insight.
A lot of the imports that we're getting into this country because of a stronger dollar are sort of helping other countries grow or stay off their bottom.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew recently cautioned global leaders not to rely so heavily on U.S. consumers. But economist Scott Anderson says pretty much everyone is counting on them, including him.
We're really hinging our forecast on U.S. growth this year on sustained consumer spending.
He says if we don't get that, things could get ugly. But he's not fretting over a few months of weak retail sales. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
You know who else wasn't fretting today? Traders on Wall Street, that's who. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whatever you might think of the current offerings playing down at the multiplex, these are good days to be in the movie business. Global box office was more than $38 billion with a B dollars last year. But the number of times we actually go to the movies has, on average, slipped in the past decade. Getting people into theaters and out of their living rooms is one of the big conversations that's happening at this week's CinemaCon, the annual gathering in Las Vegas of studios, theater owners, and all the folks who sell the candy and the popcorn and all the rest. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is there. We called her up to chat. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, Kai.
All right, set the scene for me here, would you? CinemaCon, what?
Basically, it's a trade show for the movie theater industry where all the concession sellers, all the candy guys, all the people who make movie theater chairs, yeah, and probably most essentially the studios try to convince theater owners to put their products, their movies, in their theaters. So we've seen a lot of splashy footage this week, new trailers, new behind-the-scenes stuff. The studios have brought in a lot of stars to help convince theaters that their movies are the next big blockbuster, and they should really put their marketing power behind them.
What's buzzy? What's the hot thing?
Well, it's not a movie at all, Kai. That's what's so interesting. Everybody is talking about the screening room, which is this idea from Sean Parker, basically that would allow people at home to buy access to the big movies the same day they're out in theaters. So $50, you can sit on the couch and watch Batman v Superman instead of going out to the theater.
Assuming you want to see Batman v Superman, but that's a whole different conversation.
Assuming you want to see it. This would mark this massive disruption to this industry, which is built around the idea of windows, which is basically the time when a movie's out in theater and then the window before we can watch it at home.
Sean Parker, we ought to remind people, goes way back to Napster. He made a bunch of money on Facebook. Now he's got this new screening room thing. But Adrian, I have to imagine theater owners are like, no.
Yeah, no,
right.
Theater owners hate this idea. I mean, look, they make so much of their money selling concessions. They make their money on the popcorn and soda that we buy. And they're not interested in having an option to skip out on going to their theater.
Okay, but wait, because J.J. Abrams, I think, and like Spielberg, and there are some big names that Parker has lined up behind him in this.
They have. The question is whether or not he can, one, get the studios behind him. Warner Brothers came out really strongly against the idea yesterday. Again, they weren't talking. They didn't name the screening room directly, but they came out very strong against closing these windows. So it's all going to be interesting to see how this plays out and whether or not the studios will get on board and then what the theater owners will do in response.
It's like Voldemort, which shall not be named. What else is going on at CinemaCon, which is, by the way, slightly derivative of Comic-Con? But anyway, go ahead.
So mobile ticket sales definitely have some steam. Fandango has announced a partnership with Facebook, so you can buy tickets right inside the Facebook messaging system. There's a startup called Atom here that's promising a more social way to buy movie tickets. And I think one of the reasons we're seeing some of this move to social and mobile is that it turns out, in spite of everything we've heard, teenagers still go to the movies.
Wow.
Yeah, so last year, teenagers bought the most movie tickets on average per person of any age group, which is really interesting. And the explanation the industry has is, look, they're happy on their phones by themselves, and then they want to go out in a group and be together.
And pay $17 to go see some communal experience, right?
Yeah, there's nothing like sitting in a theater laughing with your friends, laughing with a couple hundred people you don't know, as long as it's a good movie and you feel like that $17 was well spent.
There you go. Adrian Hill at CinemaCon in Las Vegas for us. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, I'm just going to say it. I miss Downton Abbey. Come on, if you watched, you miss it too. Admit it. As big as it was here, though, the hit PBS series about upstairs and downstairs lives in a stately estate left something of a different legacy over in Britain. It has focused attention on the fate of some of that country's grand old homes. The mounting costs of maintaining and repairing some of those ancestral piles, combined with the declining fortunes of the families that live in them, has left dozens of fine old country mansions at risk. Marketplace's Stephen Beard took a tour of one of them, Milton Manor, in the Oxfordshire countryside, which has been in the same family for, get this, 250 years.
When you take a tour around Milton Manor, you step back into the 17th century.
Well, we come to the hall now, which is part of the 1663 centre of the house. The wings were built on by Antony's great-great-great-grandfather.
Antony Mockler Barrett and his partner, Gwenda Marsh, have lived here for 26 years. When his mother died, he inherited the manor in all its shabby, rambling grandeur.
How big is this house?
I've no idea in square feet.
Do you know how many rooms you've got?
Gwenda, how many rooms?
Neither of them seems to know for certain, but the grandest room by far is the Gothic library.
But let me show you the room with a bit more light.
With the wooden shutters open, light floods in, but not heat. Even now in early spring, it's pretty chilly.
Occasionally, about once a year, we have a proper roaring fire in here.
What about the central heating?
Central heating, unfortunately, it's too expensive to keep on in the winter.
Which calls for home insulation, Milton Manor style.
In the winter, one wraps up warm, you know, sort of woolen things, overcoats when it's really cold.
Inside,
why not?
Nimbly climbing the stairs, Antony, with his pink cheeks and flowing snowy white hair, doesn't look the worse for wear. But age, damp and cold are taking their toll on Milton Manor.
This was my father's dressing room, and this was where the ceiling fell down. You can see it.
All the windows are in poor condition and the roof needs work. Trouble is, over the centuries, the family fortune has dwindled. Today, Antony can't even afford that basic necessity of the landed gentleman.
You don't have a butler.
What a shame. When I was being brought up, there was a butler. There was also a chauffeur who would take us to school occasionally. It's amazing to look back on it now. No.
Those days are gone,
alas. Things have changed for the worse, as my father always used to say.
This is a familiar story for Marcus Binney, head of Save Britain's Heritage. He's helped rescue dozens of country houses from dereliction. One possibility, he says, to turn the pile into a commercial venue.
What people are turning to is actually leasing houses for events, and so that you don't actually have to have a permanent staff. You can bring in a caterer, you can, you know, bring in temporary staff to do the bedrooms, and that is certainly happening.
Back at Milton Manor, they've heard it all before and tried many money-making schemes, like staging historical reenactments in the grounds. They simply don't generate enough cash. And there is a problem with opening up to paying, staying guests. The house is packed with heirlooms like this 18th century musical box. Insuring them all against light-fingered visitors would cost a fortune. I do have one not entirely helpful suggestion for Antony and Gwenda.
What you need is for somebody to write a very successful soap opera about an aristocratic family and set it in your house.
Downton Abbey is just down the road from us, and we are so jealous of Lord and Lady Carnarvon. Although they won't tell us how much they've made from Downton Abbey, I think they've done quite well out of it.
But that's the fairy tale. The residents of Milton Manor will be happy if they can just avoid the terrible fate of losing the ancestral seat after 250 years of family ownership.
My mother wouldn't approve. Wherever she is, she would immediately descend if there was any suggestion of giving up.
In Milton, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Gotta believe they made a fortune from Downton, right? Coming up,
Everybody wants the concussion-proof helmet, but there's no such thing, as far as I know. And if there is, then, you know, I want to know about it.
Forget the NFL. Let's talk peewee football, all right? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials put on 187 points today, about 1%, finished at 17,908. That is 14% up in 2 months, yo. The NASDAQ gained 75 points, 1.5%, 49.47. The S&P 500 added 20 points, 1%, closed at 2,081. Peabody Energy, the big coal producer, filed for bankruptcy protection. 8 years ago, a share of Peabody cost you $1,260. Today, $2 if it were trading. Was trading, I don't know. Some gadget news today. Analysts upgraded Fitbit 12% on strong sales of new models. GoPro popped 19% today after poaching a designer from another gadget company. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.76%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today in the Marketplace Farm Report, this item: for the first time in 20 years, the number of GMO acres, that is acreage planted with genetically modified seeds, has declined. A report from, and bear with me here because it's a mouthful, a report from the International Service for the Acquisition of Agribiotech Applications says the drop is due mainly to low commodities prices. Marketplace's Andy Euler picks it up from there.
The GMO debate is alive and well in the U.S. You've probably heard both sides. But for the people planting the crops, the decision isn't really about science, safety, or politics.
The farmers view it from an economic standpoint.
Jim Dunn is a professor of agricultural economics at Penn State University.
But essentially, most of these products are used for animal feed, or, for example, cotton is a GMO product. The arguments for them on an economic basis for the farmer are very compelling.
In the United States and other countries that produce the bulk of the corn, soybean, cotton, and canola in the world, 90% of those crops are already genetically modified, so the market could be saturated. Low commodities prices led farmers to plant less last year, both engineered and non-engineered. But GMO seeds are expensive. Mac Earhart is president of Albert Lee Seed House.
Corn and soybean prices, as low as they are, they're looking at ways to save as much money as possible. And conventional corn and soybean seed is simply a lot cheaper than corn and soybean seed that contains GMO traits.
You see, farmers think about buying seeds like we think about buying a car. You can buy the base model or you can buy the one with the leather seats. Chris Hurt teaches agricultural economics at Purdue University.
When corn, as an example, was $7 a bushel, those traits may pay off. Now corn's closer to $3.50 a bushel, and those traits may not pay off.
Genetically modified crops also haven't taken hold around the world. If countries in Asia and Africa started planting GMO crops, those acreage numbers would certainly rise. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
There was a conference at the White House on Monday about the Zika virus and what to do about it when it eventually lands here in sizable numbers. The World Health Organization has been one of the big players in trying to figure out how to tackle Zika. The thing is, though, that the WHO, you might remember, got a lot of heat for not responding fast enough to Ebola when it first broke out a couple of years ago. Public health experts say the Zika outbreak gives the organization a chance to redeem itself, perhaps. But how that might go comes down, as it always does, to money. Ashley Milne-Tite has that one.
The WHO has almost 200 member states. Each one of them pays dues. But those dues only account for 20% of the organization's funding. Stephen Hoffman is director of the Global Strategy Lab at the University of Ottawa. He says the rest of its budget comes from voluntary contributions,
most of which are earmarked for particular purposes, which means that WHO receives money, for example, from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or from different governments to do particular activities,
such as help eradicate polio or AIDS. So it gets funding, but it can't budget for it, and it can't spend it on responding to emergencies like Ebola or Zika. Lawrence Gostin is a professor of global health law at Georgetown University. He says member states should pay the WHO higher dues so it can better address public health crises.
It's one of the only agencies in the world of its size and caliber that is emasculated in the way it is, and I think everyone realizes that this is a losing formula for global health.
But he says member states don't think the WHO has done a great job, so they won't fund it. But if they won't fund it, what it can do remains limited. Stephen Hoffman says the situation has gotten worse in the last decade,
which is a decade when we've heaped on more and more onto WHO's mandate and given it really fewer resources.
He says looking ahead, the WHO not only needs more resources, it needs to be more accountable for how it uses them. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
I don't know if you saw this yesterday, but there's a paper set to be presented at the American Academy of Neurology's annual meeting this coming week that says more than 40% of retired NFL players show evidence of traumatic brain injuries. Football's concussion crisis has proved real enough for parents to keep their kids out of that sport. And the Sport and Fitness Industry Association, in fact, says participation in youth tackle football has dropped nearly 20% the past few years. In the long run, that's probably bad for the overall football industrial complex, but for one particular slice of it, helmet makers, yeah, it's an opportunity. Adrian Ma has more.
It's a Monday night in February, and a couple dozen peewee footballers are swarming an indoor field in Long Island. Number 18 has the ball, and he's sprinting upfield, looking like a 4-foot Barry Sanders bobblehead on skates. Suddenly, he collides helmet to helmet with another player and crumples to the turf. An EMT and some coaches rush over. And after about 20 long seconds, number 18 is helped up and limps off the field. Monet Williamson says moments like these are hard to watch. Her 8-year-old son Christian's also on the field. And while it wasn't him that got hit this time, she says Christian's had his own share of hard knocks.
The other day he did a hit that scared me so bad because it was like head to head and he flipped and everything, and that was really frightening for me. I was so scared. I'm always scared.
And Williamson isn't alone. Parents, coaches, and players are increasingly worried about concussions. And according to the market research firm BCC, that worry is driving consumer demand for better and more expensive helmets. Last year, the market for football helmets was worth about $100 million, and BCC expects that number to double by 2020 to around $200 million.
Everybody wants the concussion-proof helmet, but there's no such thing, as far as I know, and if there is, then, you know, I want to know about it.
Rich Polo owns a football supply shop in Long Island called Endzone Sports, and he says as news about concussions has gained public attention, helmet makers have responded by adding lots of new features.
Basically, what you're seeing is an oversized shell. Dual inflation points, so there'll be a top on the crown. Independent bonnet system. Individual shock absorbers on here. VTD to DCT is run by the chin strap.
Plastic and foam padding just doesn't cut it anymore.
You've seen more helmet changes in the past 5 years than you had in the past 30.
And with all that technology comes a higher price tag. A decade ago, a top-notch kid's helmet would set you back $150. But back at the game, Anthony Ney says he paid $300 for a helmet for his son, AJ. Ney says it's expensive, but worth it. Nace played football for years, and he says comparing the helmets he used in high school to the one his son uses now is like comparing
a Hyundai to a Lamborghini, you know?
Really? When you see that price tag, do you ever think for a second that like, well, maybe the, not the Lamborghini, but the Accord?
No, it's not an option. You don't, there's certain things you don't compromise.
Music to helmet makers' ears. But more expensive helmets might not fix football's image problem, and that's something the industry will have to tackle eventually. In New York, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. Today is one of my 8 favorite days of the economic year, which, yes, does make me a dork. We got the Fed's beige book this afternoon, the central bank's anecdotal and occasional look at the American economy broken down by Fed region. And when I say anecdotal, I mean it. The Wall Street Journal's real-time economics blog does an awesome job of pulling out the best tidbits from this thing, like this one from the Minneapolis Fed. This is a quote: logging in northern Wisconsin was slowed by a warm winter that made the ground too soft for equipment. Also, this one from the Richmond District, also a quote: an executive at a healthcare organization reported being inundated as a result of a large late-season increase in flu and norovirus cases. One more? All right, one more. From the Boston Fed, a toymaker says volatility in financial markets and uncertainty surrounding the economy at the beginning of the year had no discernible effect on demand for toys. And listen, Janet Yellen reads this thing. All righty, we are out of here. The Dow up 187 points today, 1%. The NASDAQ up 75 points, about 1.5%. The S&P 500 up 20 points, 1% there. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.